And I'll try not to make this workshop a lifetime. We're going to try to get it in right here. And here's where I'm coming from on this. This is geared towards trying to see, and the older I get, and this year I turn 49, more and more and more and more and more and more, it's on my mind, finish well, finish well, finish well. I don't want to be a flare. I mean, there's far too many believers, men and women, who there's a season of just, whoa, remember them? I don't want to be that person that people say, remember Brad Bigney? Remember, but he went down in flames, or he just fizzled out, or he walked away, or he got disillusioned, or he burned out. I'm not interested in burning out for Jesus. I want to be that slow burn all the way to the end. Burn, yes, but not burn out. Finishing well. So I'm calling this ministry for a lifetime. Now, most of you probably seen a bell curve chart before at some point in science class or in a sales meeting at some point in your life. Here's what it looks like. And the reason the bell-shaped curve is such a phenomenon in the study of statistics is because it gives an overall picture of the life cycle of something, a product or a movement. For example, let's think about the hula hoop, if you're old enough to remember the hula hoop. You know? And if we looked at the life cycle of the hula hoop, it looks like this. 1930s and 40s, no sales, Zippo. Nobody knew anything about it. Early 1950s, it starts picking up some steam. And in the late 50s and 60s, the hula hoop really took off because in 1958, a little fledgling company that no one had heard of in California called Wham-O, remember that? Sold 100 million hula hoops in 12 months and made two men very, very rich. Wham and O. No, I don't know what their names were. Wham and O got very, very rich. But it was downhill after that. And you can still find them, you know, in a toy store every now and then or a garage sale. But it hit a flat line. You think about CB radios. Remember that in the 70s? I was probably 10 years old or something. It was like, oh my goodness, that was just huge. Everybody's going around saying 10-4, good buddy. I mean, nobody does that anymore. You know, there was the movie, Smokey and the Bandit, the Trans Am, black Trans Am with gold trim. It was just like, it was just the rage. I mean, how many of you remember your parents or your granddad or somebody having a CB radio in the vehicle and it's on during your trips? I mean, how obnoxious is that? You're thinking, why? Why? But it was just like the thing. Like now, who has a CB radio besides truckers? It's like, it's done, gone, over. What about the mood ring? Remember those? And how things come and go. Pet Rock, wasn't that a hit? I mean, how many people still have a Pet Rock? Man, the silly things that have made money. Power Rangers, Tickle Me Elmo. I mean, everything has this life cycle. You know, we could go on and on, Cabbage Patch Doll and whatever. There's always something. But here's the point, and there is a point to this. As a believer serving God, doing ministry, I don't want my life to look like that bell curve. That's not what I'm wanting. You've got the believers that are not even excited yet or committed to serving. Then you get fired up and you start serving and discovering where you fit in ministry. And you come to a conference like this and you're like, oh my goodness, you mean God could use me with my Bible to help a real person with a real problem? I want to get all this I can. I want to counsel as many people I can. And so you start serving with all your strength. But then you hit a plateau. Maybe you have a couple more babies, or maybe there's a life change regarding job or health or something. Or maybe you just hit a hard spot that theologically or in ministry or in your own life causes you to stutter step. And you're struggling. And then you start stepping back from serving opportunities. And I see it in our church. You know, I watch this cycle. As a pastor, I don't want people to be drawn in, shoot high with all kinds of ministry, and then I watch them just kind of burn out. And then many times it's burn out and head on out. Because they're not sure, is there a place for me now? If I'm, it was just the other day, you know, if you're a small group leader in our church, that's pretty intense. For us, small group leaders are not just yak and snack, you know, just kind of see if you can put chairs in a circle and just kind of talk. And I mean, you're a shepherd. You're a shepherd doing real stuff. If there's problems in that group, we expect you to come alongside them and work with it. Our small group leaders are trained with biblical counseling, so it's intense. Every now and then they need to step back. So we were having a cookout with this one couple. And he had just informed us, all right, I can't lead a small group again next year. He'd done it 4 years. He's got 4 little kids, and he's a surgeon, you know? So imagine his schedule. I was always praying for them because I pray for the small group leaders. And I myself was thinking, how do they do it? And he had two really difficult couples in his small group that took lots of time. So when he informed us that, hey, I can't do it again next year, I wasn't thinking anything. Oh, all right, God refreshed them, blessed them, encouraged them, you know, helped them get a fresh wind in their sails. But there we're sitting, and I began to thank him for his service. And his wife spoke up and said, oh, he has been dreading seeing you or being around you because he thought you were going to be disappointed in us for not leading a small group. I said, no. God can keep using you as a surgeon. God's going to keep using you in our small group or in our church, and I hope that you'll be able to serve again. But I'm interested in our people having a lifelong ministry, not just peaking and heading on out and then being happy to, you know, I see these people that come into our church and I can't figure it out. They love the Lord. They know their Bible. They're seasoned, mature believers, and I can't get them to serve. But when I get around them, I'll hear them say, oh yeah, man, we led the whole children's ministry thing in the gym and the opening assembly, me and my guitar. My wife had a clown hat on. We drove the bus. And you know what? Now they don't want to do anything. As leaders, if you're here and you're a church leader, think this through. And there ought to be times that you actually go to your people and say to them, we want to give you the freedom to step back from some things. The other night, every other month, we have a small group leader meeting. So it's about 125 people there. And we gave a talk. Our associate pastor or assistant pastor gave a talk about serving. Or maybe it was the small group pastor, Tyson, I think it was. But basically, he put it out there and said, if you're a small group leader, we want you to know, we don't expect you to do anything else. So if you're teaching a children's class and leading a small group and counseling two other people and you have our permission, our blessing to step back from other things because this is so important what you're doing. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And that night, 4 or 5 small group leaders came to him and talked to him and said, oh, yeah, don't call us right now to counsel anyone outside of our group. Don't give us another counseling case. We want to work with our people and make sure that we have people who do ministry for a lifetime. Not just peak like the hula hoop and slide towards a sad end. So let me give you 4 guardrails. 4 guardrails that I hope can keep you ministering for a lifetime. And avoid the gully or the ditch of burnout. Burn with passion for Jesus, yes. Burn out, no. We'd like to drop the word out. Number one, never move on from the gospel. And I know that might sound basic to you, and it is, but just because something's basic doesn't mean it never needs to be stressed or repeated. Because in too many cases, the gospel is just being assumed. Don't ever start assuming the gospel. Look at it, meditate on it, think about it, rejoice in it, thank God for it, but don't assume it. Milton Vincent, in his Gospel Primer, says, in most of Paul's letters to churches, sizable portions of them are given over to rehearsing gospel truths. For example, Ephesians 1 to 3 is all gospel. Colossians 1 and 2 is gospel. Romans 1 to 11 is gospel. The remainder of such books shows specifically how to bring those gospel truths to bear on life. Re-preaching the gospel and then showing how it applied to life was Paul's choice method for ministering to believers. Because notice, as he writes these letters, it's like, Paul didn't take the approach of, well, duh, I'm writing to the Christians at Ephesus. They're believers. Just jump right. If we're not careful, we would have had Ephesians, the book of Ephesians, start with chapter 4. Therefore, walk in a manner worthy of calling with which we've been called. In unity, Marriage, husband and wife, chapter 5. Parenting, chapter 5. Chapter 6, spiritual warfare. Just cut to the chase, Paul. He never did that. He always rehearses great gospel truths. Gospel indicatives of who God is, what he's done, now do this. Who God is, what he's done, now do this. And we need that if we're going to, I think God knows how we needed the Bible put together. We are so pragmatic, we are so bottom line oriented, we're so get to the chase, that if we could have had our way, we would have designed the Bible very differently. You know, especially once you start doing biblical counseling, you start doing personal ministry at close range, you just think, this is not, I hope this doesn't sound awful, this is not the most useful book. It's like, God, this should have been arranged like alphabetically. Under P, you've got parenting, pride, perseverance, problems. And there's all your verses on that stuff. But it's not put together that way. And it's not put together that way for a reason.